Remember what I said in the beginning? I said in the beginning that you guys were kind of silly. No, silly for believing that I could speak for, you know, less than 20 minutes or 25 minutes or something like that. Tonight you're silly because you're trusting a New Testament PhD guy with speaking from the Old Testament. So that's an even bigger challenge. Gotta dig in and see if I can remember some things from the Old Testament, which is oftentimes you find people that get into a PhD and they kind of think the other side is like the unholy side, you know. It's like, oh, the Old Testament, oh, we don't need that. But we need that, so. All right, well, I appreciate the opportunity. I enjoy doing this as much as I can. And tonight, I'm going to basically introduce the series. I think the handout given on the series, if you can see it on the website, is a good summary of where this series is going. And not having talked to any of the other folks that are going to be preaching, hopefully I don't step on anybody's toes or say something that somebody else goes, what? And they have to, you know, say something different. But I'm going to try to set up the book of Jonah, and especially the first three verses, and maybe dribbling just a hair over just for a few seconds, just to set up what I think is the right focus of the book of Jonah. Because so very often this book, I think, is misunderstood. So really quick, just a little bit of background before we get too far. And clicker, which is the forward and back? Just the right one?
Yeah, right's forward.
Okay, just making sure. Better to flight check this stuff before, but unfortunately I spent, you know, I didn't have a PowerPoint till earlier today, and I said, you know, it's nice to have pictures of things. So I spent the last couple hours doing a PowerPoint and then conveniently left it at home and remembered as I walked in the door and Julie was about here. And so she ran back and got it. So you can thank her, or maybe don't thank her, depending on how it is. But the book of Jonah, author, nobody really knows. The book doesn't say, so honestly, it really doesn't matter. But the date of the book is very important. In general, the book of Jonah comes from the first half of the 8th century BC. So you're talking basically from about 794 to 753 BC. And I get that because later in the book, we'll look at it in a second, there's another mention of Jonah in the Old Testament. And it's basically from 2 Kings. And we know that this is during the reign of Jeroboam II in Israel that Jonah was a prophet. So we know more than likely within a few years of that time frame, this is when the book of Jonah, the events of the book of Jonah occurred. Okay, if you remember, about 931 BC, God's kingdom of Israel split into two. You have Rehoboam basically taking one half and Jeroboam taking the other half. Jeroboam goes north with the 10 tribes of Israel, you know, now called Israel. And Rehoboam is south with the two tribes of Judah and Benjamin. So now the nation, in 931, the nation is split after Solomon is off the scene. So now God's nation is in two separate pieces. And both of the nations start a downward spiral of disobedience that spirals out of control. The north, as we're going to see in this book, much faster than the south. But either way, both nations spiraling out of control in disobedience. So about first, you know, this is mid 8th century, this is happening. Now, not a lot of kids in here. I was kind of hoping there'd be a kid in here. But, you know, I might get the same result from adults. Okay? Because this should be pretty obvious. When you think of the book of Jonah, the one word, the one image pops into your mind. Give me a word for that image.
Whale.
What was that?
Whale.
Thank you. Yes. Whale. That's what people think when they think of the book of Jonah. They think of the whale. They think of the miracle of that happening. And a lot of critics of the Bible will attack the book of Jonah for this very reason, at this very spot. Now, how many of you have heard? I won't ask how many of you have preached this. I know one has. I've preached this before. I'll admit it right in front of you. How many of you have heard back in the 1800s, a British sailor who was they were harpooning whales, fell overboard, got swallowed by a whale. The fish, you know, they thought he drowned. They pulled the whale up a day later, whatever, cut him open. And this guy, this bleached sailor, you know, falls out, you know, half insane. How many of you have heard that story? It's not true. Okay? So we as evangelicals need to make sure that we don't just, and I'll say I as an evangelical, shame on me for having preached that story and other silly ones like it before, because we feel like we need to get God, no pun intended, get God off the hook. Okay? You don't need to get God off the hook. Just because we don't have a historical account of someone this happening to doesn't mean that the book of Jonah is not true. Okay? So some people have even tried to explain this part of the book as, well, it's a parable. It's an allegory. It's just trying to teach us a truth. Well, what I want to tell you is if you go that route, you need to be very careful. Because we need to see, what did Jesus say about this? How does Jesus treat it? Twice in Matthew, once in Luke, Jesus says something similar to this. Some of the experts of the law, along with some of the Pharisees, answered him, "Teacher, we want to see a sign from you." But he answered them, "An evil and adulterous generation asks for a sign, but no sign will be given to it except the sign of the prophet Jonah. For just as Jonah was in the belly of the huge fish for 3 days and three nights, so the Son of Man will be in the heart of the earth for 3 days and three nights. The people of Nineveh will stand up at the judgment with this generation and condemn it, because they repented when Jonah preached to them. And now something greater than Jonah is here." Does that sound like he thinks it's an allegory or just a story? It sounds like he's treating it as a historical event. And I think we got to be careful if we go the other way. I don't need a historical account to confirm the Bible for me. And incidentally, all the arguments against whale and all that, Bible doesn't say whale. It says a great fish, because the Hebrew language doesn't really have a word for whale there. You either got sea monster or you got great fish. They pick a great fish. Okay? Fair enough? Okay. Yeah, I think you know where I'm going. I wasn't going to put this in there, but it is applicable, and it really shocked me. 2 days ago, and I've got the name of the article if anybody wants to look it up on Fox News, they had an article, which normally you read an article in there about religion, and it's going to be really hokey. But this one was shockingly true, and I had to put a quote in it. It's from an article called "Like Chrissy Teigen, Most Christians Are Not Good with the Bible." I won't go into the Chrissy Teigen part about it, but here's the part I want you to focus on. So a 2017 Barna Group study in association with Summit Worldview Ministries found that only 17% of Christians who consider their faith important and attend church regularly, that's us, actually have a biblical worldview. The study found that 61% of church-going Christians held views rooted in new spirituality, 54% resonated with postmodernist views, 36% accepted ideas grounded in some form of Marxism, and 29% held secularist views. Another Barna survey found that, this is shocking, 51% of senior Protestant pastors did not hold a biblical worldview. Christians and their leaders don't seem to know what the Bible teaches. An American Culture and Faith Institute study found that 58% of Christians believe that 58% believe that Satan exists. That means 42% of people that call themselves Christians don't even believe Satan exists. Only 52% believe that Jesus Christ was sinless, and only 47% believe that absolute moral truths exist in the Bible and are found in scriptures. Most Christians surveyed also said that it was possible to earn your way to salvation, earn your way into heaven. And obviously, these are all unbiblical. Okay, but the last part is what I want to emphasize here. Christians, for the most part, are not good with the Bible. This is why Christianity is less influential than ever before in America, /Scotland, /everywhere else. Okay? Its ambassadors don't know who or what they're representing. I am not going to have anybody raise hands and embarrass anybody, but I've done this before in churches and say, how many of you are Christians? And everybody's hands go up. How many of you have read the whole Bible? And half the hands go up. So I'm not going to ask. If we don't know what the book says, how do we know what it says? If you haven't read it, how do you know what it means? How can we represent the God of the Bible when we haven't even read the whole book? Okay, so here's my whole point of saying this. If you haven't read the book of Jonah, it's going to be preached on over the next several weeks. It's not long. Tear it up. Read it. But when you read a book of the Bible, you need to read it with a goal. You need to read it going, why is this here? Don't do it like I did the first couple times I read the Bible and go, okay, I got to get through the Bible in a year. So I have to read 65 verses a day in order to get through the Bible. Oh no, I got 50 verses today. I got to read 75 verses today to get through the Bible in a year. And you know what you get? You get through the Bible in a year. That's about all you get. It would be better to grab a couple books and read it over and over and over and over and over again and tear it up and tear it up and tear it up and cling to it. And I'll be out of context here, but like, you know, cling to it like someone in the Old Testament that clung to God, you know, in a wrestling match and said, I'm not going to let go of you until you bless me. Grab a book, grab Jonah for now and read it. I'm going to tell you what I think the book of Jonah is about as a main purpose at the end of the message today. However, you know what? I might be just getting part of it. Read it. Read it for yourselves. Know it. How can we be God's ambassadors if we don't know the material? And how dare we say that we're ambassadors of the one true God if we don't know what he's said? If the president of America, you know, wrote me a letter, or if a general when I was in the military wrote me a letter, you better be sure I was going to read it, because that's pretty important. If for the young people, some movie star wrote you a letter, you'd be like, wow, I feel so honored. I can't wait to read it. God wrote us a letter. He wrote us the Bible. So we need to read it. Okay. Am I done thumping? Sorry. Read me. Okay. Let me just read this real quick. This is basically the beginning of the core of what we're talking about tonight. So in Jonah chapter 1, verse 1 to 3. Okay, it just basically starts right in. It doesn't introduce Jonah. Like I said, it doesn't really say a lot about Jonah because Jonah's not the focus of the book. Now, the word of the Lord, this is all, I'll be reading all from the ESV tonight, by the way. Now, the word of the Lord came to Jonah, the son of Amittai, saying, arise, go to Nineveh, that great city, and call it against it, for their evil has come up before me. But Jonah rose to flee to Tarshish from the presence of the Lord. He went down to Joppa and found a ship going to Tarshish. So he paid the fare and went down into it to go with them to Tarshish, away from the presence of the Lord. So tonight's message is going to be fairly simple in two parts. I'm going to talk about the command, and I'm going to talk about the disobedience. Now the command, you got someone the command's being given to, the messenger, and then you got the command itself. So that's where we're going to begin here. Okay, so the first thing, the command, it's going to the messenger. Jonah is God's prophet. This message, the word of the Lord, came to Jonah. Now, what about Jonah? Now, you got to be really careful here. Jonah's name means dove. Amittai, son of Amittai, means truthfulness. So you've got dove, the son of truthfulness. Now, most people that deal, you know, are more adept at dealing with Jonah than I am, the Old Testament scholars, would say that not every time a name, you know, a Hebrew name doesn't always have this hidden meaning in it. And I think that's probably the case here. I've not found a commentator on Jonah yet that really made a big deal out of the name. But I do find it very ironic, whether it's intended in Scripture or not, that I will not stand on that ground and say, this is intentional. But I will say it's very ironic that someone whose name means dove is the son of faithfulness. What are doves known for in the Bible? You've got, you know, Moses sending out a dove on a mission, right? You get that part, okay. Doves are known for mourning. And doves are very often spoken of, especially in the Psalms, about fleeing. Flee like a dove to the mountains. Flee like a dove to the clefts of the rocks, that kind of thing. Doves, any of you hunters? Yeah, I'm Texas. I lived in Texas for a while. I've dove hunted many times. And when you come up, you'll be walking through a field and there's nothing there, and you got your shotgun and you think you're all by yourself. And then all of a sudden, they fly right up out. They're not hanging around waiting for me. I haven't even shot the gun yet. And they're known for fleeing. So this is a person who's known for fleeing, who's the son of faithfulness, or the son of someone who's faithful. Okay? Like I said, don't think it's intentional, but it does give me kind of pause to go, you know what? There might be something there. Okay? So this message, God's word comes to this fleer. God's word comes to this person who's the son of faithfulness. Okay? Now, again, like I said, the Bible doesn't talk about where Jonah, you know, much about Jonah. But there is context here. And it's often important to look up context and other passages in the Bible that'll help us understand what's going on in Jonah. So if we want context for this, we got to go to Kings. So turn to 2 Kings chapter 14 real quick. 2 Kings 14, 23. Because I think this is especially, this context is it should really set up the problem with Jonah, especially in the beginning of the book. Okay, the ESV reads 2 Kings 14, 23. In the 15th year of Amaziah, the son of Joash, king of Judah. So this is the time period of that split, that 793 to 753 time frame. Jeroboam, the son of Joash, king of Israel, began to reign in Samaria, and he reigned 41 years. So this is Jeroboam the second. You had a Jeroboam in the beginning, you know, 150 years or so prior to that. Now you got Jeroboam the second. Okay, Jeroboam reigned 41 years. To verse 24, and he did that which was evil in the sight of the Lord. He did not depart from all the sins of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, his predecessor from many years before, which he had made Israel to sin. He restored the border of Israel from Lebo Hamath and as far as the Sea of Arabah, according to the word of the Lord, the God of Israel, which he spake by his servant Jonah, the son of Amittai, the prophet who was from Gath-Hepher. So there we get a little added detail. He's from Gath-Hepher. For the Lord saw the affliction of Israel was very bitter, for there was none left, bond or free, and there was none to help Israel. But the Lord had not said that he would blot out the name of Israel from under heaven. So he saved them by the hand of Jeroboam, the son of Joash. You can go ahead and flip back if you want to Jonah. So let me get this straight. Solomon dies, the nation splits, Israel is rapidly. Not one of the kings of Israel, the northern kingdom of Israel, is known for being did that which was right. It's always did that which was evil, and some worse than others. It seems like every other in Judah is, you know, did evil, did right, did evil, did right. So they got partially, did a little better. But Israel is did that which was evil. And Jeroboam the second is no different than Jeroboam the first. That's why he's probably called Jeroboam the second. Okay, so Solomon dies, the nation splits. It doesn't it say in verse 24, maybe I should have had you stay there, but in verse 24, I'll leave this up. It says they did that which was evil in the sight of the Lord. So what do you expect at this point? A blessing or punishment? I expect punishment at this point. I expect God to just send somebody in and squash them at this point. But that's not what it says. In verse 16, it says, God saw the affliction of Israel, that it was very bitter, and there was none to help Israel. And because of that, because of his promise, because of his word, because of what he would not blot out the name of Israel, what does God do? It says he saved them. They expand their territory, regain some territory, and Israel is saved. That, you go, I feel like Jonah a little bit. I'm going, what? Okay, let me get this straight. They disobey, they did with that which is evil, and God saves them. Okay, God pours out mercy, basically, in this instant on his chosen people, even though they deserve nothing but his condemnation and wrath. Keep that in mind. This is the same prophet that's delivering this message. This is the same prophet that we're talking about in the book of Jonah now. Okay, there's no ambiguity here. This is the same guy. So that's your messenger, this dove, possibly known for fleeing, although in the book, yeah, he's definitely, whether it's by his name or not, the guy is known for acting like a dove and fleeing. Okay, he's given a message, and he's choosing not to obey the message. So let's look at the command itself. Okay, two-part command, arise, go. Okay, when the Hebrews do that, and they put those two together like that, the translation really is something to this effect, go immediately. They put the two commands together like that, and basically what he's saying, and your translation may say that, is go now. God is not asking for a debate. God is not saying this is something I want you to do in the future. God is not saying, you know, I think this would be a good idea. What do you think, Jonah? God is saying, get up now and go. And he's telling him to go to Nineveh. So what's the deal with Nineveh? Okay. You may kind of understand Jonah a little better and be a little more sympathetic with him if you understand what Nineveh was. Nineveh eventually, not at this time, but eventually became the capital city of Assyria. Assyria are the absolute bad boys of the day. Assyria is conquering the known world. The darker green is from about, like I said, 824. The lighter green is what they expanded to just, you know, 100 plus years later, okay? So basically they're expanding, and every one of these conquering nations, be it Assyria or Babylon or the Romans, whoever, they all come through this area here, and Judah and Israel are right in the middle of it. All the traffic comes through this area because of the roads along the coastline and all that. It is a natural choke point, strategic choke point, for every conquering nation that has ever been in this area. Okay, and so Assyria is basically, at the time of Jonah, Assyria is on the rise. And they are known for their absolute brutal. Now I'm kind of glad there's no kids in here, because I'm going to get a little, just very quickly, get a little specific. Because I want you to understand what Jonah's, what's probably going through Jonah's mind. Okay, we think ISIS and all these people that behead and do all these things are bad. And they are. Assyria, oh my goodness, Assyria was bad. Okay, these are actual reliefs taken from stone carvings that deal with Assyria. This one is supposed to be the Assyrians impaling Jews on poles. Okay, believe it or not, I mean, it's hard to see in the picture, they would flay their victims alive. And here's one that you may have heard as well. This one's hard to see in this picture, but they're carrying heads. The Assyrians were known for their shock and awe tactics. What the Assyrians would do, I mean, think about, you're walking back to your hometown and you're mad, and the Assyrians have been, you know, killing and pillaging and raping and all that. But you want to do something about it. And you come walking through your city gate and there's a pile of 100 heads in front of the gate. And you look in faces and you know half the faces. You might think twice about rebelling against them as well. Okay? These are brutal people. Brutal, brutal people. And God is saying, get up immediately and go preach to Nineveh. I could think of a lot of emotions that would go through my mind right now, like, what? La, 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 la. I didn't hear that. Okay? But this is basically the God, and think about the message I just read. Think about the 2 Kings passage I just read as well. Okay? What did it say about Israel in this passage? Did that was evil in the sight of the Lord. Okay? So that's what Nineveh is basically about. At this point, some people will attack the book of Jonah and say, well, it's obviously false because it says that Nineveh is the capital city. It doesn't say that. The Hebrew says it's a great, prominent city. The word does not necessarily mean capital. It did eventually become the capital. But again, Bible scholars at times will get very silly, especially the non-believing type, and they'll attack the Bible at any point. So if you ever see somebody say, well, it's not correct because Nineveh wasn't the capital city at the time, it doesn't matter. It was a great, prominent city. Supposedly, the walls were so wide that you could ride several chariots down the top of the walls. Okay, that's a big city. So it was a very extremely prominent city. And the rest of the book of Jonah, a 3 days journey, is talking about in Nineveh. Okay, so it's a very large city. Now, Jonah, the chosen messenger, what's he told to do? He's told to go cry out against it. It just basically means God says, I have a message. I want you to preach against these people that pile heads in front of cities, okay? And basically what it says that they're evil, ESV says, I don't know what yours says, but it says their evil has come up before me. Literally, it means their evil is right in God's face, okay? This is not something they're trying to hide. This is not something being done secretly behind the Lord's back. This is being done in plain sight of God, right in his face, as if he has no power or no authority to do anything about it. And that's the way the Assyrians are operating. So this prophet is told to go immediately and preach against these leading tyrants of the day. That's the message. And the reasoning is because their evil has come up before God. It's in God's face. Now I want you to notice the disobedience. So the command, arise, go to Nineveh, cry against it. What does Jonah do? Jonah arose. It sounds good immediately. It almost sounds like you're rereading back what exactly the first that verse said. Arise and go. And he did just that. He arose and he went. But the problem is he didn't go immediately, quickly to where he was supposed to go. He went immediately, quickly in the opposite direction. Okay? God says go this way, and he says, that way looks good. And that's the way he goes. So he's basically saying, I'm not going to do what you said. Okay? Remember, God told him to rise up immediately, and he did, but he went the wrong way. So Jonah is going which way? I know, fancy topographical map of the area, as best I could do. You can see Nineveh up there in the corner. It's got the little, one of the little lays out, it doesn't matter. Nineveh up in the corner. Israel, most likely, the text doesn't say, but most likely Jonah is near Jerusalem. From the presence of the Lord, you think, where's the presence of the Lord supposed to be? In Jerusalem, in the temple, in the Holy of Holies, that's where what it's known for. So more than likely, Jonah is on or around Jerusalem at the time. So what does he do? Instead of heading east, Jonah heads to Joppa, which is right parallel. Joppa is almost due west of Jerusalem. So Jonah turns his little nugget west, and he goes right to the coast. He goes to Joppa, the seaport. And where is he? It says he wants to flee to where? Tarshish? Scholars don't know for sure where Tarshish is, but you can be sure it's west. Okay? Some people think northern Africa, like Carthage. A lot of people say Spain. That's why this person put that on there. Doesn't matter. He's on the very eastern end of the Mediterranean Sea. Any boat he's going to get on is pretty much going to be heading west. And you can be sure that's exactly what he's doing. That's kind of the point. It'd be the same as if the Bible had said, and Jonah went, bought fare into a ship to head to Timbuktu. He's trying to get out of Dodge, to use an American Western expression. Okay? So he is out of there. Jonah is going in the exact opposite direction God has commanded him to do. Now, do you think Jonah really thinks in his mind that he's going to get away from God's presence? Probably not. You see, David wrote Psalm 139 before this. More than likely, Jonah knows Psalm 139. If he didn't, and I started to, but I didn't have time to finish it. I tried looking to see if anybody had found a link, between Jonah and Psalm 139. And all that, and I couldn't. But my goodness, if you read this text, it almost sounds like we're reading. Oh well, ignore the 2 Kings part. I'm just showing my silliness. That's Psalm 139, but that's actually Psalm 139. So ignore that. Where can I go to escape your spirit? Where can I flee to escape your presence? It's a rhetorical question. The answer is nowhere. If I were to ascend to heaven, you'd be there. Well, clearly. Okay, if I were to sprawl out in Sheol, in the grave, in the Old Testament, it's often translated hell. It means the grave, the place where the dead go. Okay, if I were to sprawl out in Sheol, that you'd be there. If I were to fly away, this is the interesting part to me. If I were to fly away on the wings of the dawn east, the wings of the dawn. He's saying if I were to fly west. Okay, if I were to fly away westward and settle down on the other side of the sea, i.e. Tarshish, okay, even there your hand would guide me. Your right hand would grab hold of me. Yeah, and bring you back. Okay? Very applicable, is it not? He's a prophet. He's leaving the promised land. He's running away from God's presence, the Shekinah glory of God in the temple. And he's running away. He's not trying to get out of God's presence. He knows he can't do that. But what he is trying to do is, Jonah knows, I'm a physical person. I have a physical mouth. I got to physically go to Nineveh. And I got to open my mouth against them headloppers. And I got to tell them something. So if I'm not there, you can't make me. And he's basically saying, send someone else. This prophet is fleeing the coop, if you would. That dove is fleeing the coop, okay? He's not going to be a part of this. Send somebody else, okay? So, but here's a part that may not be really obvious from the text. I do believe this is intentional, because the Hebrew makes this very clear multiple times in the very beginning of the book. And this is where I'm going to tread a little bit on some other people's territory, just very briefly. Because not only is Jonah fleeing westward, but Jonah is also fleeing downward. The Hebrew text makes it clear that he is fleeing west and down. Okay? In general, if you keep in mind that Jerusalem is very often referenced as up to Jerusalem, Mainly because, I mean, for one reason, because of geography. Jerusalem is you know, the temple in Jerusalem is elevated. It is high up. But I think there is also a spiritual reason there as well. If I ascend to heaven, you're there. Okay, God is in the minds of the Bible writers up. Death and hell are down. Okay, Jonah is fleeing. And here's why I don't think that I'm making it up. Look at verse 3. Jonah rose to flee, in verse 3, to Tarshish, from the presence of the Lord, temple, right? He went down to Joppa, and he found a ship going to Tarshish. So he paid the fare, and he went down into the ship, to go with him to Tarshish. Again, away from the presence of the Lord. Verse 5, but Jonah, the storm is now arising. He's out in the sea. Jonah, what does he do? He goes down into the very farthest part he can go right now, into the inner parts of the ship, and he falls asleep. Until what happens? The sailors realize that there's a Jonah on board. British sailors are known for, you've heard that story? British sailors calling somebody bad luck on the ship a Jonah. Okay. There's a Jonah on board, and he offers, he says, I'm the reason, I'm running away from the one true God, and they're like, you know, they're not God, they're not followers of the one true God, but they're seeing something that's scaring the snot out of them right now, and they're going, okay, you're a follower of some God, and the God's mad at you. He says, yeah, just throw me overboard. So he gets thrown down into the water. And then later in verse 5, in chapter 2, verse 6, this is Jonah's psalm from the midst of the fish. And what does Jonah say? The wonders closing over me to take my life. The deep surrounded me. Weeds were wrapped around my head at the roots of the mountains. He's at the depths. He's as low as you can go on the earth, under the water. I went down to the land whose bars closed upon me forever. It seems like he's giving up. Yet, you brought me up, my life from the pit. Oh my God. Jonah is going westward as far as he can go. Jonah is going down from Jerusalem to the seaport. He goes down into the ship. He goes down into the hold of the ship. He gets thrown down into the sea, and he's at the very bottom. I went down to the very bottom, basically, is what he's saying. Yet you brought me up. Jonah is trying, and the Hebrew narrative, Hebrew narrative is known for trying to paint a picture and to bring you into the narrative so you get an idea of what's going on. And I think this is intentional. He's going west and he's going down. I'm getting as far away from the presence of the Lord as I possibly can. Okay, as of course we'll see, once he confesses to the sailors and they throw him down, God brings him up and God brings him back. But that's a story for another preacher coming up. So let me just leave you with a couple concluding thoughts. Things to keep in mind as you, hint, hint, tear through the book of Jonah over the next couple weeks, which is always a great idea. You tear it up first before the preacher tears it up, you know, so that you can, you know, oh, I saw some things there. Oh, he hit that, but what about this? And you can ask, hey, we can have a dialogue together as you know, fellow Christians. Don't expect somebody just to feed you. Feed yourselves. So this is quite a journey. Jonah is fleeing from God's call on his life. He's running in the exact opposite direction from God's presence in Jerusalem, westward and downward, westward and downward, westward and downward, until God basically arrests Jonah. And he runs right into the arms of the most merciful and gracious God. And I think, returning back to the purpose, that's the purpose of the book. The purpose of the book is not to show you, oh, what a wonderful fish story we have here. Oh, look at this. We can tell a nice story to our kids about a whale swallowing a guy and spitting him up on the land, and we'll just leave it at that. That's not the point. And the point is not the disobedience of Jonah. Jonah is not center stage in this book. It's God who is center stage in this book. Jonah's disobedience is not the main purpose. The main purpose of the book is not necessarily to tell you, now don't disobey, or you might get swallowed by a fish. That's not what the purpose is, obviously. Many people have speculated that Jonah was some hyper-nationalist. Luther, I believe, was one of them. He says, you know, Jonah just doesn't want the Gentiles to get saved. I don't think that's quite it. It might be close to the truth, but I think the point is not that Jonah didn't want Gentiles to get saved. I think it's that Jonah doesn't want the Assyrians specifically to get saved. Jonah knows God's character. Jonah, and you'll read later in the book, Jonah knows exactly what God's going to do. He just doesn't want to be part of it. Okay? He also probably doesn't want to lose his head, add his head to a pile. That might be part of it too. But like I said, the book is not focused on disobedient people, but on the amazing, gracious God who commissions people to do impossible things and scary things at times as well. So hopefully as you read through the book, I want you to focus on a couple things. Oh, sorry, that's kind of dark. Some concluding thoughts. First, do you, like Jonah, consider some people groups, some religions, to be undeserving of God's miraculous grace? I was in a church one time where a group of deacons, okay, basically, I just joined this church and I'm out to lunch with the deacons, trying to get to know them, right? I'm just a lowly Bible teacher sitting with a bunch of older men, deacons, and I'm in my 40s and they're in all their 60s and 70s. And they start talking about homosexuals as if they are beyond the reach of God's grace. Shame on anybody that believes that as a Christian. Shame on it. And it was disgusting the way they were talking about it. And I instantly became the enemy of the deacons from that day forward because I spoke out against them and said, really? And I kind of challenged them a little bit. They didn't like that. Oh, well. Muslim jihadists nowadays, blowing up, you know, are we, you know, if God told you or told me to go to Iraq or whatever, or do something like that, do we think that these people don't deserve the grace of God? Shame on us if we think that either. Okay? If so, we might have a Jonah amongst us. I have been a Jonah before. I know in my mind when you know, trying to figure out what God wants me to do in my life, I've thought many times, well, I'll do this, but I won't do that. Okay? Be careful. So that's the first thing. Is there anything? Is anyone outside the bounds of God's grace in your mind, at least in your attitude, and then secondly, in your willingness? So what would you, or have you said, no to? If God told you, the God of the universe, the God who made all things, the God who we serve, the God who sent his son to be crucified on the cross and die a horrific death for us, told us to do something. The God that says in the book of in 1 Corinthians 6:20 said that we're basically called us slaves. We're doulos. That's not just servants. If your Bible says servants, that's fine, but it means slave. It means you've been bought with a price. Therefore, glorify God in your body, which is His. So, if God told you to go do something, is there something that you have said, or is there something that you would say no to? Okay, because if so, at some point, like Jonah, you may get arrested and sent back. Okay? So the point of what I'm trying to say is this book is about God's grace. This book is not about disobedience. It's about the grace that arrests and overturns disobedience. In this case, God used some miraculous means to overturn the disobedience of his prophet. And you would expect that with a prophet. God could use some amazing ways to overturn our disobedience as well. But it sure be a lot better for us to say, yes, Lord, and to do as it, and not test that arresting grace, if you would. Okay? So the downward spiral of disobedience really can end in two places. Either God will arrest you, or what happens if God doesn't arrest you? What happens if he just lets you keep going? Okay? There's some people that have been running all their lives and don't want to do anything God says. That's not a good sign. Okay, if you're a true Christian, God's going to arrest you to get you to see his way of doing things and what he wants done. God will move mountains. God will do all kinds. God will create a fish in this case to get Jonah to do what he wants to get done. It got done. God could have done it using another prophet. God chose to use Jonah. If God chooses to use us, God's going to accomplish it. Okay. His grace is overpowering of our disobedience. Kind of similar this morning. I was encouraged with the message this morning. Very similar, if you think about it, to what we heard this morning about Peter, isn't it? Peter denying Christ three times to the face. Do you love me? Yeah, you know I love you. Do you love me? Yeah, no, yeah, I love you. Well, didn't you just tell these people that with a curse that you didn't know me? Yeah. And God's grace did what? Christ didn't come and condemn him and say, you, out of the circle, get. God used him. And Peter became a wonderful servant. But it takes that arresting grace to take somebody who's naturally disobedient, like we are as doves, to just flee at the first sign of danger. Amen. That's all I got. So I think we got communion now, right? Thanks.
Thank you very much, Jim. What an incredible message and an incredible introduction to Jonah. I do want us to respond. I want us